Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
They are a house in New Orleans. They call a rising sun, where many poor boys to destruction has gone, and me, oh God, for one.
House of the Rising Sun, in a rare 1933 recording. It's a song famously about ramblers and gamblers, lost hope and ruin in old New Orleans. It showed up in the Kentucky Hills maybe a century ago, topped the rock charts in 1964, then, against all odds, went global. In a new book, my guest today, Ted Anthony, has tracked down the song's many incarnations through the years. This hour on Point, a journey into the cultural roots and recording history of House of the Rising Sun. You can join the conversation. What is it about this sad old song of ruin that's given it such wide appeal? And have you pictured yourself in the House of the Rising Sun? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me from New York is Ted Anthony, author of the new book, Chasing the Rising Sun, The Journey of an American Song. He's worked for the Associated Press since 1992, twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. He's been posted all over the world, but his obsession is right here in this song. Ted Anthony, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You weren't even born when The Animals made it a number one hit in 1964. What's plugged you and so many people around the world into this song, House of the Rising Sun?
Well, I think it's, from the very beginning, it's a song that has almost a blank canvas to it. It's a really adept balance of specificity and universal themes so that it doesn't get too specific, so that it becomes something that you can't identify with, but yet it leaves you wanting more. It leaves you wondering, what could this have been? What is this legend that is responsible for so much misery?
We'll have a generation and more who know this song like the back of their hand from that big sort of rock version of it in the 60s. And others who may not know it at all, though it's hard to believe given how much it's played on Muzak and everything else, as you write, all over the world. But give us the story, the sort of basic line of the story told in this simple, sorrowful song.
Well, it's about ruin. It's about pain. And for the most part, it is usually about New Orleans. When I first started paying attention to the song, my surmise was that it was from New Orleans, but it quickly becomes evident that it's not, because you see lines like "down in New Orleans," like "I'm going back to New Orleans." Mm-hmm. But it just evokes the notion of vice, of ruin, of a life gone wrong, and that life could have gone wrong in a whorehouse, in a gambling hall, in a prison. It usually isn't specific enough to say. And although most people have concluded that it was a bordello, there is a lot of case to be made for all three alternatives.
It's got these great phrases running all through it that are just part of American pop culture. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy or girl, depending who's singing, and God, I know I'm one. My mother, she's a tailor. She sold those new blue jeans and the ball and chain. Someone's gonna wear when they go back to New Orleans. They've fallen in love with a drunkard and a rambler and a gambler, or been one, and ended up there. I love your telling of how this story sort of comes to us out of the mists of time. You travel all over the country and around the world, trying to track down the exact route and sort of come to the conclusion that this is generated by a bigger sort of cultural aura than any one taproot can be traced to.
I think that it definitely is. You look at the lyrics that you mentioned, and so many of them are fragments that appear in other folk songs throughout American history in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And you see that this was very much something that, whether it was consciously cobbled together or whether it just sort of quickened into something, it became, it drew from all of these traditions, many of them Appalachian, and it came together into something that someone somewhere once told as a story. That's not something that I ever found out where it came from, but at some point those disparate strands sort of flowed together like streams into a larger river and became a story.
Go tell my baby sister, never do like I have done, to shun that house in New Orleans they call the Rising Sun, whether a prison or a poorhouse, or most commonly thought of bordello. And you tell the story of this great moment in 1937 when Alan Lomax, of course, who had been sent out by, persuaded the Library of Congress to let him head out into the Appalachians, shows up in Middlesboro, Kentucky, and finds a 16-year-old girl named Georgia Turner who sings this song into his big old recording machine. Tell us that story.
Well, it's a pretty amazing story, and it's made even more amazing by how prosaic it is. I mean, there were all of these things percolating then. There was happenstance, the fact that Lomax happened to stop in Middlesboro before other places. There was the fact that he knew someone who knew someone who set up a group of people in a very poor neighborhood of Middlesboro called No Town to come over and sing into this giant, bulky device that Lomax had in the back of his car called a Presto reproducer that cut acetate discs. And what happened was one day in September of 1937, he showed up. The people who were going to sing for him showed up. He was looking for material. He was at that point looking for sort of two kinds of material. He was looking for the Elizabethan ballads from the hills that remained pure and hadn't been stepped on, but he was also finding himself looking for more hybrid songs that reflected the experiences of the 1930s, mining and depression and all of that. And so on this day, in this little cabin on a hill in Middlesboro, Kentucky, he records this girl named Georgia Turner. She was 16, and she, like her mother, did a lot of singing. She walked around the neighborhood singing this song. People I found who were there and who knew her at the time said no one knew where it came from, but that it always came straight from her mouth. They never heard anybody else singing it. Their neighborhood was by a set of railroad tracks, so that increases the possibility that she may have heard it from an outsider. But wherever she heard it, she, you know, leaned in and sang into this Presto reproducer, and Lomax captured it on the acetate disc and went back to Washington with it and put it in a book and spread it around to his friends, who he had some friends.
And the rest is history. Hold that thought, Ted. I want to hear it. It's such a remarkable moment. Here we are, Middlesboro, Kentucky, just west of the Cumberland Gap, 1937. Imagine a 16-year-old girl living in a poor part of town down by the tracks, picked this up somewhere. Maybe she knew a rambling man herself. Listen to the what sounds to me like straight-up sadness in this voice. Here's Georgia Turner, as recorded by Alan Lomax, 1937.
So tell my baby sister, never do as I have done, to shine that house in New Orleans, they call a rising sun. My mother, she's a sailor, she stole those new blue jeans. My sweetheart, he's a drunkard, Lord, Lord, drinks many years.
Georgia Turner, Middlesboro, Kentucky, 1937. And there's the source material that got spread all around. 1964, it went to number one. And we want to hear that version just to get a sense of the span. This is what made it famous all over the world.
A house in New Orleans, they call the rising sun, and it's been the ruin of many a war. In God, I know I'm one.
Now The Animals, 1964, it knocked A Hard Day's Night out of number one, I think, in the UK. It's an incredible span between those two, Ted Anthony, and we will look at it with you. But what a journey from Middlesbrough to right there, number one, rock and roll, House of the Rising Sun.
What's extraordinary about the journey is that it took 27 years, that's all. You listen to the 1937 recording you just played of Georgia Turner, and it looks backward. It looks into the history of America, into, I think, as you put it, into the mists of time. And the Animals version is so modern, so psychedelic, so driving that to think that only 27 years passed between those two versions is pretty staggering.
And somehow so glamorous compared to that plaintive sound of Georgia Turner in what sounds like a thin old dress at the edge of the tracks.
It is glamorous, and it's in fact, that's one of the things you walk away with it from, is that although Eric Burdon of the Animals, feels painful and ragged, by the same token, there is an allure to it that you feel when you listen to the 1964 version.
We're going to come back and look at that 27-year journey and what put House of the Rising Sun right at the top of the charts and into the heart of popular American culture. Ted Anthony is with us. His new book is Chasing the Rising Sun, The Journey of an American Song. We'll go out listening to one of Ted's favorite versions, this one from Steve Power, who found the honky-tonk strains for this 2001 recording. You can join the conversation, Why Do We Love to Hear About That House in New Orleans They Call the Rising Sun? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Send it down to that parchment farm where that ball and chain. There is a house in New Orleans called the Rising Sun. Been a ruin many a poor boy. God, I know I'm one. And God, I know I'm one. And God.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great American ballad of life gone wrong, of gambling and drink and sin and New Orleans, House of the Rising Sun, with Ted Anthony, author of Chasing the Rising Sun, The Journey of an American Song. You can join the conversation. What is it about this lament, played right here by Mark O'Connor and Vassar Clements, the great Vassar Clements? What is it about this song found in the Kentucky hills that keep it playing all over the world? And do we all want to feel this sinner's fall with them and try to rise again? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Just listen for a minute to Mark O'Connor and Vassar Clements. They're feeling it. They're feeling it right there. And millions have. Ted Anthony is with us from New York with his Chasing the Rising Sun. And a lot of people, Ted, want to join this conversation. Let's go to Jim in Springfield, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Ted, did the animals say what brought that song to their attention, what version they may have heard?
How did the animals find out about it? It's a great question. And there's a terrific, huge story there. Ted, what do you say?
Well, the animals, they listened to a lot of folk music in Newcastle upon Tyne in England, particularly Eric Burdon, the lead singer. And among the versions that they really made an influence on them were one by Josh White, who was an African-American blues folk singer from the early 1940s, and also Bob Dylan's version, which had come out in 1962, a couple years before the animals recorded theirs. And And at the same time, there was a musician who played around Newcastle named Johnny Handel that Eric Burdon used to listen to, and he heard Handel playing this and just started thinking about it. When the Animals wanted to record something really staggering, they decided they were going to be joining the Chuck Berry tour in the UK in 1964, and they said they realized early on you can't out-rock Chuck Berry. So they decided to do something with House of the Rising Sun, and that's where it gets mucked up a little bit. There began something of a controversy between Eric Burdon and Alan Price, another member of the Animals, that would last for many years.
Alan Price got all the money. Eric Burdon got all the glory, but wished he had some of that money. Ted, I wish you'd wind the tape back even a little further, though, to that moment. What brought it in, even to Josh White and Bob Dylan and Nina sure. Simone and Joan Baez and, you know, the many others who recorded it? Alan Lomax comes out back through the Cumberland Gap, I guess, with this recording. Who initially picks up on? Of course, Woody Guthrie's in there. What was the circle of people who were ready and waiting to jump on this kind of sad, plaintive, old American song?
It was a fascinating percolation, I guess you'd call it, that was going on there in the late 1930s, early 1940s. Lomax comes back from his 1937 Kentucky trip and starts transcribing these songs, getting them arranged, and comes out in 1941 with a book that has many of the songs he collected in it called Our Singing Country. And at the same time, Lomax is palling around in Manhattan with a bunch of folk singers, some of whom are well-known then, some of whom would become well-known in the years to come. People like you mentioned Woody Guthrie, like Huddy Ledbetter, Leadbelly, he's known as, like Josh White. And they would get together in apartments in Manhattan. They would eat, drink, smoke, and play guitars and try to outdo each other with their knowledge of songs. And Lomax introduced this song into that circle. People started singing it. They started adding their own traditions to it. Guthrie was then with a group called the Almanac Singers that included a very young Pete Seeger. They recorded it in a version that sounded very much like the Georgia Turner Kentucky version. And those recordings started appearing. And as the 1940s progressed into the 1950s, those recordings became some of the basic texts for the beginning of the folk revival. And musicians who were looking for inspiration looked to Woody Guthrie, looked to Josh White, looked to Leadbelly, and they took the song and they ran with it. And that's sort of how it started hurtling toward where the Animals would pick it up and where before them Bob Dylan would. It just gained momentum.
And, of course, Bob Dylan took it from, what was it, Ronk?
That was another bit of a brouhaha. Dave Van Ronk was...
Dave Van Ronk, that's right.
Dave Van Ronk was a well-known folky around the cafes of Greenwich Village in the early 1960s who befriended Dylan when Dylan showed up from Minnesota and became something of a mentor to him, I'd say. And Van Ronk had this version of the song that he loved to play that he had sort of picked up from a woman named Hallie Wood, who in turn had picked it up from Lomax. And Van Ronk rearranged it, did it in an even more haunting way than Hollywood had. And Dylan picked it up from Van Ronk. And one day Dylan comes in and says to Van Ronk, you know, that version of House of the Rising Sun you do, do you mind if I put that on my first album? And Van Ronk says, well, you know, I'd rather you didn't because I'm going to do something with it. And Dylan gets this look on his face and says, well, you know, I have something to tell you.
And it's on there, baby.
Yeah. And the funny thing about that was that eventually, when Van Ronk tried to play it, people would accuse him of copying from Dylan.
And, of course, once the Animals brought it out electronically and it went to number one, Bob Dylan soured on it, never wanted to play it anymore because it was then their song, this old sad song, suddenly the coin of the realm. You write, Ted, about Grill Marcus, who's been our guest on this show, the great sort of music and culture critic, talking about the songs of this era, maybe this among them, surfacing what he called the invisible republic in American culture. What did he mean by that? How does it show up in House of the Rising Sun?
I think I've come to firmly believe that there really is this sort of other America, and it's in some ways an America of the mind. It's in some ways an America of the past, but it's an America that contains our mythologies and contains our traditions, and because of that is a place where, you know, In a way, and I'm not speaking obviously literally here, but in a metaphoric way, magic can happen. He called it the Invisible Republic, and I used a construct in my book calling it the village, the place where all of these people who populate these folk songs live. And I think that it's very much sort of a state of mind that was the context for all of these songs emerging. Greil Marcus and Harry Smith before him, the guy who put together the Anthology of American Folk Music, they envisioned that it was somewhere in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s when there were enough of these stories in miniature, these fragmentary lyrics and tiny tales to come together to provide a reservoir of folk tradition for musicians to draw from. And that's where I believe House of the Rising Sun emerged from. It was in this old weird America, as Marcus calls it, that this stuff came together, and that these stories that had been percolating, some of them from as far back as Elizabethan England, mm-hmm. some of them from the African American folk tradition, that they were blending as the musical traditions blended, the cultural traditions blended as well, so that these kinds of stories took on a sovereignty of their own, I guess you'd call it, mm-hmm. and things like House of the Rising Sun started emerging that had the specifics of this America, but also the generalities that always accompany folk tradition.
Right, weird and wonderful myth and the power of these stories of falling and maybe redemption in that rising sun somehow. Let's get a call from Michigan, Lexington, Michigan. Michael, you're on the air.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
One of the reasons that I think, if anything, but the awareness of the song, when I was young, 8 and 10 years old, I was trained in piano and guitar. And in the lesson book one of both, and I think this holds true for many of the song books, in the lesson book ones, other than the Mary Had a Little Lamb, little ditties that you play, the graduating song is always House of the Rising Sun. And at 8 and 10 years old, that was the song. That was like one of the first songs. That was the first song that I played and the first song that I knew all the way through, words and music, you know. So interesting that people that might have taken lessons, and I think that holds true today, that's the song that they graduate from.
Absolutely, Michael. A whole generation of guitar players, for sure, Ted Anthony. You remind us, grew up with this as sort of the first challenge and the first goal, those great guitar licks that we heard from the Animals.
It's pretty amazing because I can't tell you how many people have told me that that's the first song they learned on the guitar. Almost as many people as have told me that Eric Burdon wrote the song. but people... Apparently, and I don't play guitar. I've tried. I haven't been successful. But apparently, my friend Colleen Long, who it was the first thing she learned on the guitar from her father, she says it's like a parlor trick. It sounds very complicated, the progression of chords. But once you master it, it's quite easy to do. I mean, Bon Jovi, it was the first song he learned on the guitar. And it seems to be that sort of Ur song that if you can play this, you're on your way to learning the guitar.
Let's hear a real down-home version from 1959. This may be one of your favorites, and it will take us on to a wonderful singer who's going to join us from Nashville in just a moment. But let's start with Roscoe Holcomb, itinerant laborer, Eastern Kentucky, plucking and crooning House of the Rising Sun, House in New Orleans, in 1959.
Are we on down and on, yeah?
Roscoe Holcomb, 1959. We're going to hear in just a moment from a cousin, I think, of Roscoe Holcomb, Virginia Blood, who sings this song very much alive and kicking today. But Ted, first, what do you hear in this version from Roscoe?
I hear the hills. I hear the traditions that he comes from. I mean, it feels... You know, we throw around the word authenticity, and authenticity obviously means very different things to different people. But
yeah.
I hear something authentic in his voice, something that speaks of the experiences he's had and the places that he comes from. This is when I first heard this, I had to listen to it 4 or 5 times before I could convince myself that it was the same song. The words are the same, but you hear, I mean, his guitar. It sounds like there's two people playing the guitar. His fingers are moving so fast, but it's... it's actually only him. And I guess I hear very much the traditions from which this song comes. This is a pretty remarkable version, and he was a remarkable man.
It sure is. I want to flash forward now, if I may, to you were on your honeymoon. You come across a Nashville band called Mixed Company, M-I-X-T Company, and here it's sung by Virginia Blood. Listen to the rendition. Listen to the blazing banjos we'll come to.
My lover, he was a drunkard. He drifted from town to town. And the only time he was ever satisfied was drinking.
Virginia Blood and Nashville's Mixed Company singing right there. Virginia Blood joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee. She and her two sisters are Mixed Company. Virginia Blood, thank you very much for being here.
Well, hello, Tom, and thank you for having me. This is a pleasure.
Tell us about singing this song, what it does for you, and what it does to the audience when you come to House of the Rising Sun.
This is a song that when we play it, especially with the banjo, it kind of mesmerizes the audience. I like now you are probably aware there's about 11 different verses.
Yes, to this song. Many ways to sing it.
Oh, yeah. And so what we did was select the ones that we felt most in tune with or that said something that we wanted to get across. And I know a lot of folks think this is a man's song, but I've always heard it more as a woman's song. We've had some radio stations around the country and around the world that's played this and had calls in and saying, wait, why are women singing this song? But I just always felt like it was more, it had things to say that were more from a woman's point of view.
We certainly heard young Georgia Turner singing it there as a young woman.
Yeah.
When you sing it, Virginia, what do you picture? Is it a bordello, a whorehouse in New Orleans, a prison, a plantation house? What's this place that the singer, she maybe, has fallen into?
I think it's a gambling house and a bordello combined. That's what I picture in my mind. And to me, this song is all, it's about sorrow. And it's about sin. It's about repentance. It's about, I wish I hadn't done it. I wish I could do something different. And I think it's a song that everybody can identify with to at least a little bit of degree, because I think everybody probably has a few little regrets in their life that they wish they hadn't done or they wish they'd done something differently.
No kidding, but there's no getting out of this. She's going back to New Orleans to wear that ball and chain.
She can't stop herself.
She can't. Is there some kind of allure in the listening, Virginia? Do we want to sort of live out that fall into ruin?
No, but I think it does kind of paint the picture that there's an awful lot of people that once they get on a certain path, they might stop for a while, they might transfer or take another path for a little while, but they probably will end up going back to what they've always known.
Is this one ever going to go away, Virginia? Is this one going to be part of the American songbook forever now?
Well, it always has been, and humanity is pretty much like that. So I think this is probably a classic song for all times and for all generations.
Virginia Blood in Nashville with Mixed Company. It's a beautiful version. We'll listen to a little more. We thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom, and greetings to Ted. And you folks take care up there.
Made a great honeymoon. Thank you, Virginia Blood. Ted, you hear it. She loves to sing it, and it comes right through.
It's pretty amazing. I got to hear this sung and played on their back porch in Nashville a couple years ago, and it was a cool night, and the crickets were singing, and it occurred to me, you know, this was so many decades after the front porch music moved to the larger pantheon for this song, and it came back to a front porch. It was a front porch in the suburbs in Nashville, but it was people playing not to perform, but playing because they loved music and because they cared about what it said. And
sounds like a good way to hear it. Ted, we got to take a short break here. Ted Anthony's new book is Chasing the Rising Sun, The Journey of an American Song, House of the Rising Sun. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Woody Guthrie, one of the earliest popularizers of the song. Here he is in his 1941 version. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
New Orleans, that they call and ride. sun. It's 1 foot on the platform, 1 foot on the train. I'm going back down to New Orleans to wear my ball and my chain. My life is almost over. My race is almost run. Going back down to New Orleans to that house of the rising sun.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Liberty Mutual, for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility. What's your policy? And the law firm of Sharon and Lodgen, 60 years experience in real estate, business transactions, and civil litigation, legal precision and innovation, sherin.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, looking at the House of the Rising Sun. There is a version you may not know. It's the Moaners doing Paradise Club, contemporary female band out of Carrboro, North Carolina, with fresh lyrics there, telling the story of a local strip club that led girls down the same path as New Orleans' House of the Rising Sun. We're talking this hour about the great American ballad of life gone wrong, gambling, drinking, sin, and New Orleans, House of the Rising Sun. Ted Anthony is my guest. He's author of Chasing the Rising Sun, The Journey of an American Song, and it has really and truly been around. But it made its great big splash in 1964, number one on the charts. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Of all the great blues laments, why did this one go to number one and spread everywhere? And do you remember the first time you heard Rising Sun? Did it send a shiver down your spine? 800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Bristol, Connecticut. Fran, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're good. What do you hear, Fran?
I couldn't believe it when I started to hear, I love your show, but this has been one of my favorite songs since 1968 or 69, and I remembered exactly where I was when I first heard it, and a local band was playing it in a club in Bayonne, New Jersey, and I must have been about 19 or 20 years old, and we used to go to dances every week.
Yeah.
And this was, yes, and it was just one of those great vocal band songs, and the music was that rhythm that you could dance slowly to. And so it sort of has that sensuality about it. But I think when I started to listen to the words, this was a time in my life and in many people's lives. It was the 60s. And we were becoming aware of the poverty, the racism. We lost Kennedy, we lost John Kennedy, we lost Martin Luther King. And I think a lot of that ball and chain and that sadness, we were fighting poverty and Vietnam, was a metaphor for what was going on in the world at that time.
And yet, Fran, you were dancing to it and dancing. Fran, let me just ask you, you were dancing and dancing, slow dancing to it, which meant there was a kind of romance around it as well, obviously not just a political message.
Oh, I thought it was a really sexy song. I hope my kids don't hear me say that. I did, and I always, after I learned, more about the song itself and the words, and as I was older and, bought the LP, which I probably still have in my basement from the Animals, and really listened to those words, and I think that it was a sadness about a poverty or a way of life that I never experienced or understood growing up in a town a city outside of New York. So it gave you a connection to what was going on in the world in the early 40s or 50s, but never knowing where that song truly came from. So to have this kind of history for me was very exciting. And I thought, how obscure is this that someone would actually write a book about this song that I loved? And it still gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. But I still think the Animals did the best job with the music as well as the words. I wish there was a female singer who sang with them. I think that would have really just brought it way over the top.
Fran, you bring that moment right back. Slow dancing, no less, to House of the Rising Sun. Way back then. Fran, let me give you another version. Think about this one, Fran, when you do your way back machine. Here, 1988, an entirely different approach to House of the Rising Sun from Ever Eve. Hardcore punk spin on the song, like its precursor, anger, darkness, heavy metal, mosh pity here. Here we go. Fran, do you want to cuddle up with your honey and slow dance to that one?
No, but I'd like to be with a group of people. Enjoying it. I think it's wonderful that every generation or every era or different kind of music can really take that song and relate to it and communicate it to young people when they're feeling so many things emotionally and growing and learning and in transition. And I think it really addresses... not only your own small world, but the world that is around you.
Fran, you put it beautifully. We've got so many who want to join us, but we're really grateful for your call, and thanks very much for coming in with that. Ted, there's that, I guess, in 60s, the latching on to both the sort of political message, the cultural new world, the invisible Republic of Grill Marcus, and also the romance of all that. I mean, it even said, to sew my new blue jeans. We even had blue jeans in it. Talk about 60s.
I think that that speaks to the character of the song, which is pain, which is lament, but also something very alluring about it, I think was the word she used. The notion that that there is a big story in this song, and it's somehow epic, even though it's also very personal. I'm not surprised that the 60s was when the big bust out of this song came, because you listen to the Animals version. I mean, maybe I'm speaking in retrospect. Granted, I was born in 1968, but... It feels like it could very easily be a soundtrack to so many of those events she mentioned, because there's drama to it, and there's a sense of urgency and a sense of events hurtling toward some conclusion that we don't know what it's going to be yet. And that is very much how much of the 60s seemed to be.
Going back to New Orleans, my race is almost run. Going back to spend the rest of my days beneath that rising sun. Jonathan's calling from Boston. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the show.
Yeah.
I guess I have my next book in my summer reading, eh?
It's pretty
very
fun.
Very exciting. Thank you. I love all the different versions. I always love Woody Guthrie's version, and I love the versions with banjos and fiddles and everything. And I love the variety there. And now I want to point out a version that really puts it on its head, and that's the Blind Boys of Alabama, who do Amazing
Yes.
Grace. Yeah, to the tune of the House of the Rising
Sun. Amazing Grace to the turn of House of the to the tune of House of the Rising Sun.
The Eric Burdon orchestra, version of it. So
how well do you know it, Jonathan? The Blind Boys. Can you sing that one for us?
Oh, absolutely! Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me, and so on.
Wow, you got it. I don't know if the Blind Boys are going to swoop down on you, but you carry it well.
I sing along with it every time I have that. It's on the Spirit of the Century recording that they did a number of years ago.
It's terrific. And Ted, do you know that version, the Blind Boys version?
I do. And in fact, they're one of two groups that did that to Amazing Grace. It's pretty amazing. It shows again the elasticity of the song. They decided to grab it and co-opt it for the story that they wanted to tell, and they took a little bit more of a drastic approach, and more power to them for it. I think it's a wonderful version, but it does speak to the notion that whoever you are, whatever your experience, there are elements of this that you can take and make your own.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, we're grateful to you for bringing that straight to us, and thanks to the Blind Boys of Alabama as well. Let's go to Phil in Ashburnham, Massachusetts. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm just calling. I'm really enjoying the show. I'm a musician and a high school music teacher.
Yeah.
And before I ask a question, I want to just attest to the fact of that song as a rite of passage for young musicians. My kids are crazy to learn that song when they hear it, and then they will jam on it for hours once they know it. It was a great day in my life in 1964 when I could finally cover Alan Price on the keys on that tour.
A kind of coming-of-age moment. I've got it.
I had a question for your guest about the progression. It was mentioned a couple of minutes ago.
The chord progression there,
yeah. The chord progression, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very unusual progression. It's just about unique. I don't think, except for the Yardbirds famously copying that set of changes for For Your Love and then a variation of it for A Heart Full of Soul, I'm not sure that I ever heard it before.
Phil, can you hum out for us the part of that progression that most strikes you for the non-musicians among us? Can you hum it out? Where does it really catch your ear?
Wait, hang on 1 second.
Yeah.
It goes from it starts on a minor chord, goes up to a third. I'll play it.
Yeah. Oh, we got a master class going here. Ted, what can you tell us about that?
And it's very unusual. It's not a blues, and it's pretty complicated for an Appalachian ballad. I wondered if his researches had revealed where that came from.
Let's hear, and thank you, Phil. What do you say, Ted?
Well, I would say, first of all, I want to indemnify myself. I'm by no means a music expert, and in fact, I can't even read music. I'm just starting to teach myself how to play the piano. I came at this much more from a history perspective. But that said, I know that beginning in The Animals, which was played on the guitar by Hilton Valentine, it is, to my mind, extremely, extremely rare. The only times I've heard it other than what you mentioned were people who were trying to riff off of The Animals. The one interesting thing I did find was in one of the versions that that Josh White recorded in the 1940s, he's the one who took it into a minor key in a much more brooding ballad that The Animals clearly picked up on. But at the end of one of his performances of that on an acoustic guitar, he plays almost that exact arpeggio. And it's just as the song is fading out, and I can't help but wonder, this is not something that I ever asked Eric Burdon or any of The Animals, but I can't help but wonder if that's one of the places where they picked it up, because it does appear in that early 1940s version, but it is, to my mind, extremely, extremely rare.
But, of course, there is that old British root that you've toyed with this song, Ted, the notion that this goes back way pre-blues into English culture.
That's very true. It does suggest a lot of relationships that go way, way back. I mean, although I only have really evidence back to the 1890s, there are elements of it that link up to a very old ballad called The Unfortunate Rake, which also gave us the song Streets of Laredo and the St. James Infirmary, although I found no evidence that Rising Sun is directly related to that. But it also old-time British folk singer named Harry Cox, who Lomax recorded in England in the 50s. The guy was already very, very old, and he sang a very ribald and downright obscene version of a song that didn't seem related, except there was the last verse was, if you go to Lowestoft and ask for the rising sun, there you'll find two old whores and my old woman's one. So there it was, without any mention of New Orleans coming from the British tradition, and that was an extremely intriguing dead end.
Right, with the rising sun and a fallen woman, his wife. Let's go to West Virginia and Morgantown, West Virginia. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Paul. You're on, my friend.
Oh, no. It's Jim from Hyde Park, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, I was wondering why no one spoke to me when I got on the air.
Sorry.
How are you doing, Tom? No, listen, I know you're pressed for time here, but what I was going to say is I've always considered a blues song, and I don't think it's a very unique phenomena in blues songs, because if you look at the credits for Cream, for Derek and the Dominoes, for Hot Tuna, I mean,
sure,
Crossroads.
These rivers fed all those musicians and many, many more in that era.
Have You Ever Loved a Woman? These are, if you look at the credits, some of them don't even have, they have traditional.
Right.
So they weren't credited with anybody, and they go back as far as anybody can think of. You know, you're talking about, and I'm talking about other songs too, like by Sun Ra, and
Oh, you can go right on and on and on with that list. No question, they dipped in this river.
This was the interesting part to me, was that this song happened to have a rich history, but we could have done this with a lot of different songs in the American tradition. I mean, in some very real ways, the House of the Rising Sun was a stand-in. It was the engine for the search to go looking for how these streams flow into this river. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we could have been another song that led to other journeys, but the point is that we have this American musical tradition that all flows into what we know today, and those of us who weren't exposed to those earlier traditions, like many in my generation growing up, we thought that the music began when we bought it off the shelf, and now many people think the music begins when you download it from iTunes. And the fact is that there are all those streams rushing into this river. So you could have done this with a lot of different works.
Let's hear where those streams continue to rush. Here's the rapper Wycliffe John using melodies from House of the Rising Sun, Lauryn Hill in here as well, for this collage song titled Sang Fezzi, song about police brutality in Haitians.
You should know that one day we are gone. So keep your head to the sky. See the path we reveal.
Wycliffe John and Lauryn Hill. Finally, Ted, what is it, you think, Americans find in this song? What is it that it magnifies about themselves that they like to see magnified? Or, you know, what's the vicarious walk in the dark? How do you interpret the ongoing popularity? It's back here again.
Well, let me first say that there's one very unromantic answer to it, which is, as your previous caller mentioned, it is a traditional song in the legal sense, which means that if you do your own arrangement, it's free to record.
Right, it's yours. You can do it right now, yeah.
And so a lot of people put that on an album, whether it be as filler or they want to just try a new take on it. And with that, it keeps getting reborn because a lot of people have access to it in a way that doesn't involve a lot out of the wallet. Mm. So that's one aspect of it. But I think, obviously, it goes deeper than that. I mean, Americans love narrative arc. Americans love the notion of following someone through a piece of drama. I mean, reality TV is an example of that. And this is a life in miniature, you know, a drama of what happened to someone, how they went wrong, and what the resolution is. It's certainly not a Hollywood ending in that it doesn't end well, but it has those elements of America. It has the road, you know, one foot on the platform, one foot on the train. It has journey. It has an attempt at redemption. It has taking the railroad, ostensibly taking the railroad south. It has all of those little cultural cues that we think of when we think of the American tradition.
And at the end of the song, we are still headed back to New Orleans to wear that ball and chain. Ted Anthony, it's been tremendous fun looking back into the mists of time here and pulling it out with you. Chasing the Rising Sun is the book. Ted, it's been wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's been great.
We'll go out with Lead Belly and the Rising Sun. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.